Yep. Give me a nod when you're ready. Shooter's ready. Stand by.
Everybody, welcome to this episode of Bolts and Bourbon. I'm Frank Gao, joined by my co-host Matt Gunlock. Today we have some recurring guests. We have Stephen Corson and Peyton Garcia. They've been on as individual guests before, but today we are talking to them about them attending the European Handgun Championship in Greece. Both of them were selected by USPSA to travel abroad and serve as range officers for this event. They were able to shoot it as staff day, and I mean, it was an entire ordeal. They planned it, they went, they executed, and we're going to talk about the entire thing from logistics to the actual shooting of the match. Before I start, though, the first question I want to throw is to my co-host, actually. Matt, you were the staff and COIC of the shooting team for quite a while. Were there any endeavors to push any of the disciplines abroad, and how did those go?
Realistically, no, there wasn't. I mean, the most shooting abroad we ever did was going over to Okinawa and shooting there. I think Chris Scott got the most practice transporting firearms overseas whenever we had to bring the M18s over to Okinawa, which that was a fun endeavor in itself because, like, those Japanese people would just open the case up, pull them right out in the middle of the airport, and we're just like, what the fuck is going on? But, like, you know, prior to coming to the team, I shot competitively. I had seen, like, the world shotgun shoot, rifle shoot, you know, pistol shoot, stuff like that. And I always wondered, why weren't we ever involved in any of these international type matches? Like, this is something that we could totally do. And, you know, a few months prior to me retiring, you know, Captain Bodziak and I, we were sat in the offices whenever he first got there, and he was talking to me about it. And we were talking about international shooting teams, and you know, that someone wanted to start up an Olympic shooting team on the Marine Corps shooting team again and start competing internationally. And my first thought was, why? And, you know, it really comes down to, we would never be good enough to go and compete in the Olympics. And it's not to say that nobody there has the skill to do anything like that. It's just, we don't have the funding. It would take years. It would probably take an entire career for somebody to get to that level and have the foundation set for that to actually occur, just because funding, training, and support. And I was like, but another direction we can go, because we have the resources, we could get the funding, is competing in the IPSC matches. And he was like, what's that? And I told him about it. Now I was like, you know, we want to bring back and compete on the international stage. We have the guns, we have the ammo, we have the time to train, we have the ability to compete at a very high level doing something we already compete in, so why don't we do it? And then, you know, it's really cool because fast forward, you know, a year, and we have guys, you know, Steven and Peyton going to the European Handgun Championships. We're sending Go King and Muller out to the world shotgun shoot. Like, those are fucking wins. And we had the funding, we had the support, we had the practice, we had everything we needed. And it was just somebody making the decision, like, fuck yes, let's do that. That was cool. And I'm really happy to see that occur. So congrats, guys, for, you know, being the test bed for it to start happening.
Yeah. Thank speaking you. Of speaking of test beds, there's traveling internationally is I mean, traveling domestically, not a big issue. But once you leave the country, there's a lot of other logistics that need to be planned. So we'll start from the beginning. First questions for Stephen. When did you all find out that this would be happening? And then can you just walk us through the logistics of planning a trip abroad with guns?
Yeah, so it goes back to going the whole pistol team, pretty much the majority of the Marine Corps shooting team, late last year in October. It was something I was working with Major Hitchcock about, getting pretty much anybody who wanted to be RO certified in USPSA. So that worked out. And the whole point was because, as Matt brought up, funding is an issue. So if you don't have the money to get paid to go to matches, how do you go to more matches without, you know, paying thousands of dollars out of pockets? And the answer was, we'll just volunteer as much as we can. And ultimately, that's where it originally started. And then at the beginning of this year, 2023, USPSA, the organization, sent out an email talking about the European Handgun Championship and soliciting volunteers to work the match. And I was sitting in my house that night, looking at my emails, and that popped up. I was like, oh, this is a pretty cool deal. Unknowingly, Sam Nelson was doing the same thing. He messaged me saying, hey, have you seen this? I was like, I'm already working up an email. So I typed up an email. I sent mine off that night. And then when I got into work the next day, started coordinating with the other guys, be like, hey, this is a legit opportunity. They pay for the hotels and everything. And at the time, we were completely planning on everything being out of pocket because, again, funding was an issue. So first opportunity to be able to shoot out of the country. I believe that was February, March when that started. Sent out emails. And then it was while you and Sam were at Dragon's Cup that we actually kind of – we were going. But before that, Yi Min, the USPSA president at the time, called me because he recognized our names just knowing us from matches. He said, and I had been contacting him about other matches and getting slots and whatnot to nationals. So he reached out, and I talked to him, said all of our experience, what matches we'd be working, the Area 2s, Area 3 matches. So he put our names on the list after talking to me. He knew we were good people, and then found out that two of us got selected while y'all were at Dragon's Cup. So four of us put our names in. Unfortunately, the EHC match director just picked the top two names because they only needed three Americans, and there was another American who had a lot of IPSC experience, so they took him first, and then me and Peyton got lucky and being, you know, C and G last name. So that's how it worked out.
Yeah, I guess that balances out from all the times you get screwed by being at the top of the order when you're shooting matches. So glad it worked out for something good. Okay, I do remember we ran into Eamon out there at Dragon's Cup, and Sam and I talked to him about it for a little bit. What about for you, Peyton? So just in terms of planning, what all went on your side after you found out?
Well, fortunately, I had Steven do the brunt of everything, so I was kind of like a little leech that I was on his back the entire time. Really fortunate to have him, who has prior experience like traveling abroad. This would be my first time leaving the country with guns, even, and that was a nightmare. But most of the planning was, thankfully, Steven.
Did you have a passport before you found out?
I did not. So I had to rush it. I had to expedite the process. My issuing country was actually, or my birth state was actually wrong, so I had to change that last minute. So it was kind of a nightmare.
So Peyton from Kansas wasn't actually from Kansas.
Kansas was actually Peyton from Virginia.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's definitely not your birth state.
I mean, you should have just like seen if you could get a rush order of a red passport, and you know, you're technically on orders.
Well,
I just went down the. Wasn't on orders. We were kind of on orders because we were under DTS, but it was kind of like a weird gray area.
That's orders. Like, you just have to print out the orders from DTS, and you would have been able to go.
Well, that's the past. We're in the present.
But the blue passport is. I mean, having a red passport is nice, but yes. Your blue passport. I mean, you can make future trips with that thing, and it also doesn't expire for like a decade. So approaching international, there's a lot of information on domestic travel, but on the international side, like, what information sources did you guys refer to when figuring out, like, you know, the customs issues, ammo, all that stuff. And Peyton, we'll start with you this time.
Well, it's kind of a conglomerate. It was a lot of prior people who had traveled abroad, like Matt Nash was a huge source of information for us to travel. If it wasn't for dudes like that, our guns would probably still be in Europe. But it was a lot of information that we gathered from, like, the local dudes who have gone to world shoots, who have gone to EHC in the past, and just kind of like per happenstance of going to borders and realizing we need, or the border custom support, realizing that we need a form to bring our guns back, which was a kind of a last minute ordeal.
Yeah. Steven, what information sources did you guys pull from?
Yeah, Peyton pretty much hit it. So the EHC website, they did a good job of putting up everything required to get into the country. And that was a different headache because you're communicating back and forth to somebody who doesn't speak English as their primary language. But there was information on the website for EHC. It's like there's two different permits you had to fill out and everything had to be perfect. Luckily for us, the match took care of the grease permits. They do this every 3 years over there. So the countries who host these competitions are pretty forgiving. So they expedite that stuff. So that was nice. We didn't have to go to the embassy or anything to work that. But like Peyton was saying, we didn't know the U.S. requirements. And I hadn't thought about needing identification for bringing guns back in the country because, you know, to me, the only time I've taken guns out of the country was deploying. So, and I did nothing then. So Matt Nash helped a lot. We shot Fredericksburg at one point. He was there and we were talking to him about it because he's done, you know, the world shoot and whatnot and other matches. So he was actually a lot of help in just ensuring that our paperwork for the United States was in order.
Okay. I got something, you know, quick to say about transporting guns across borders and everything. So when I was in Romania, we had to go down to Bulgaria. And I was taking my entire platoon down there. So, you know, I had to get all the proper paperwork through the S1 shop. And I was like, hey, what do I have to do to bring all my guns, machine guns, you know, rifles, SMAs, mortars, what have you? Oh, you just have to have a serialized list. And so I'm thinking this is kind of sketchy because this is a serialized list that I made, you know, it's my regular, you know, EDL. So we hit the border and go on. And so, you know, I had scribbles all over the EDL as well. And the guy, and the guy was, you know, sees all the weapons. I hand him the roster and he's just looking at it like, and kind of like, you know, looking at all the guns and he's like, I keep. I was like, no, I keep.
No.
He's like, and he's like, okay, hands it back. And we just continue to drive on through. I was just like,
yeah,
he
didn't want to deal
with that. Wow. I mean, I could easily become an international arms trafficker right now.
That's funny.
Yeah. So Steven, you mentioned that World Shoot just happened in Thailand just the year before. So, and people learned some hard lessons, you know, flying in and out of Thailand. Did any of those, I know you talked to Matt Nash, but did you listen to any other sources of information just from people talking about the experience of going to Thailand and possibly having issues coming back?
Yeah. So I did listen to one. It was a casual shooters podcast. With I forget his name, and you probably know it.
It was June Kim. Yeah.
Yeah, June Kim. Yeah, yep. So I listened to his entire thing, like driving into work and coming home that day. So that podcast actually helped out a lot, talking about ammo and whatnot. It's one of the reasons we ended up ultimately buying. Well, two reasons really, buying match ammo there. For one, we didn't want to try to travel with, you know, 700 rounds of ammunition, and two, we couldn't use our traditional match ammo because it's all hollow points. Hollow points aren't allowed in Greece, so we had to buy FMJs. So we didn't want to buy FMJs in the state just for something bad to happen. So we bought the match ammo, which had its own difficulties once we actually got into the country, which is a whole nother ordeal. But yeah, the shooting, the podcast from Casual Shooters, that was, you know, between that and talking to Matt Nash, that was the really only things we got from the world shoot. But those two things was pretty much all we needed. It mitigated almost everything except on the return trip. We ran into a small hiccup, but we can talk about that.
I have a quick question, you know, in regards to match ammo. So, like, I'm a reloader. Frank's a reloader. Like, we're very particular about the ammo that we put through our guns. We know what our gun's like, how it runs on that ammo, and all that stuff. And you guys are very much accustomed to the ammo that you train with and that you compete with. Buying ammo over in Greece, did you feel, were you nervous about quality, about reliability? Like, did any of that come into play whenever you guys were competing over there?
100%. I zeroed out of stage because the match ammo had harder primers than 363.
Oh man.
And the Shadow 2 wasn't setting it off because
did you have to switch out a spring?
I did. Mm-hmm. So I had it set for it would fire off 363, no issue, pass the gear check and whatnot, but ultimately ended up having issues on a stage that compounded on the second stage. So my first two stages of the day was absolutely terrible. In addition to there's no downtime in the match. You had 2 minutes per shooter and there was no break. If you weren't ready, you were kicked to the back. And if you weren't ready, by the time it got to you again, you were absent from the stage and you were DQ'd at that point. And the match director had to put you back in.
Wow. Holy shit.
On top of being only five people on the squad.
Yeah.
On staff day.
On staff day.
Jeez. Was that done on purpose?
No. So all the staff, it actually became kind of a disaster for some of the staff. So all the early people that got there that actually set up the stages, they didn't know, but they weren't allowed to shoot the match because in previous years, people argued that they had too much of an advantage setting up the stages. So they found out after they all showed up to set up the match that they weren't allowed to shoot. So a lot of people got knocked off at the very beginning.
Holy shit. I bet, you know, and not to talk bad about anything that they do, but like I'm thinking about it and it's like, you know, you rely on support as a match director to help build a match, to help facilitate and run a match. And by saying thank you for coming out, but you can't shoot. I mean, you've got to think what kind of support are they going to get next year whenever they run that? I mean, it's just it's a rhetorical question here, but it's kind of like, fuck.
So the one cool thing. So USPSA, outside of the gifts you get, like out of random prize drawings for ROs or whatnot, the IROA or the International Range Officer Association is completely different. So they actually pay their ROs pretty well.
Okay.
I made friends with a Canadian, Steve, don't forget his last name, super cool guy. I worked a stage with him. But he was telling me to go to the World Shoot, and that was just to go to the World Shoot. They were given $3,000 from their organization to go. So it's not like USPSA where dudes are pretty much on their own for like 99% of it. IROA gives out pretty good money, especially as you do more matches, you get different levels. He was explaining to me to where you're compensated fairly well.
No, that's okay. I can get behind that. I mean, like, is that something like, something that's offered to everybody there?
Only the IROAs. So there was there was a lot of NROIs. Like me and Payne were just NROIs.
Okay.
Know, normal USPSA ROs. Steve was NROI for Canada.
Okay.
So NROIs didn't get anything other than the basic per diem.
Now the guys who were NROI or whatever you call it, did they get their flights paid for or did they just get the money?
They got lodging paid for, and then that's pretty much it.
Okay.
Yeah. We'll definitely get into IPSC culture. That's really interesting to me that's the way things went down, especially during staff day. But yeah, we're definitely going to talk about IPSC culture later on.
Sure.
But before that, like still leading up to the match, you mentioned that communication with the IPSC like match director was difficult because he didn't speak English. How useful was USPSA in facilitating communication Stephen, we'll start with you.
So me and Peyton were pretty much in the dark the whole time. So after the fiasco, if you will, with Yimin, where he was relieved of his presidency over USPSA, because I was in direct contact with him. I had his phone number and everything. I was talking to him through emails. And then, you know, when he got relieved, we didn't know what we were going to do. And I actually messaged him afterwards, after he was already out of the office. And I was like, hey, man, really sorry to hear what happened. But I need help. Who can I talk to? And then that's when he actually reached back out to the MASH director over there. Because at that point, it'd been like a month and we hadn't received any information. And there's timelines you have to meet for like the weapons permits for the country, making sure that we are actually registered as shooters in the match, which I don't, Peyton was registered at like last minute. He can talk about that a little bit, but yeah, it wasn't too well. I actually sent out an email to the director of NROI for us. I was like, hey, you know, what's working with E-Man? Obviously that's not a thing anymore. So what do we do? Do we have to be on your roster? Because for just normal American shooters that were going over to compete as teams, they all have to be on a roster from USPSA. The regional director or the acting president at the time has to send all that off. I was like, hey, do we need to be on these rosters? He was like, no, you're good. Like, but we have Layton, the director of Area 2, who's going to be the lead USPSA representative going over there. He's coordinating for all the regular shooters, so reach out to him. And Layton, once I finally got a hold of him, that took about another 2 to 3 weeks. And I think we were just missing each other on communication. He answered a good bit of information as well. I should have mentioned him earlier, but he turned out to give a lot of good info just on what to expect. But other than that, it was sending emails back and forth about once a month to Greece, just asking for updates because they don't give updates like USPSA match directors do or staff coordinators. So,
as in they're not proactive with pushing out information?
Yeah, that's correct. And I mean, there was almost 2,000 people shooting the match. That's just shooters. And then they got, you know, I don't know how many different countries there was there. I'm sure we'll get into that. But a lot of things to coordinate. So I don't blame them. I'm sure it's very difficult to host a level 4 IPSC match. But yeah, it's if we weren't being proactive, I don't think we would have been as successful in our ventures.
Hmm. How did it look from your side, Peyton?
It was mostly what Stephen covered was just pushing a lot of information through Paulo, who was coordinating a lot with us. And it was just a lot of translating, broken English, as much as he, bless his soul, he tried. But like, we'd send an email, it'd take like a month for anything to come back, and then we'd respond back to it. It was a lot of like telephone games. And then it was Layton who kind of gave us the majority of the information, but it was more so pertaining to their team itself. So we had to kind of translate what was for us, and it's pure chance on us actually making it there.
Hmm. Yeah. What was the deal with you getting added to the match last minute?
That was more so I wasn't keeping up on emails, and then I responded in it, and I got counseled by Paulo, and then never let that happen again, and I did not. I did not let that happen.
Dang. Yeah, sounds like a lot of work. But we've talked enough about the administration and the logistics. Talk a little bit about getting ready for the actual shooting. So USPSA is a different flavor of IPSC, different targets, different rules. How did you prepare the way you shot, the way your gear was set up, and your mindset for this match? And Peyton, we'll start with you.
Lots of hands relaxed at sides. That was a very tough thing to break. Reorienting gear to where it's behind your hips, our general like gear setups for carry optics, at least, isn't kosher for production optics. So I had to increase my mag carriers and increase magazines to 15 rounds, or decrease them to 15 rounds and have more magazines, which was kind of a learning curve because it's different reload, different indexes on magazines, and then bringing the holster back and canning it in a way, in a manner that's not going to offend anybody, really. We kind of went in dark because the only interpretations that we had on the rule sets for IPSC was off of the actual matchbook, the actual like rule book for IPSC. But since World Shoot, some of that stuff has changed. So like gear setup for example, my CZ wasn't sure what grip panels were kosher, what safeties were kosher, if I can have a Cajun spring kit in my gun. So we eventually had to go over with multiple gear setups, multiple guns, different configurations with like stock springs, stock everything on standby. We were ready to do a complete workshop on resetting our gear when we got there, which was good that we brought all that, because when we got to the actual gear check itself, both me and Steven had to alter our gear in some like small manners. But rule book was...
Can you talk about how you had to modify your gear?
I had to, I had the Cajun's safety billet with the adjustable trigger sear.
Okay.
If that's loosened a lot, the safety won't actually engage in double action fire. So I had to pop my gun open and back that up a little bit. And then another thing I had to do was remove my magnet. I had to remove my magnet because it was ever so slightly in front of my hip and mm-hmm. put it on my belt.
Gotcha. Okay. Interesting. What about you, Steven? What did it, just in terms of preparations, shooting and gear?
Yeah. So, after Care Optics Nationals, I switched over to shooting production, and I think I started moving stuff a lot earlier than Peyton. So I moved everything behind the hip at that point. And I was actually really looking forward to being able to put 15 rounds into a magazine after shooting production for a couple matches. And then at all the, so at Area 8, and all the locals, I started just practicing IPSC rules. So I wasn't trying to do stage walkthroughs like before the day of. And then I just watched stage runs and then keep it strictly to the 5 minutes, hands relax exercise, as Peyton was saying, not taking any sight pictures. And then trying to, once I got the command make ready, just trying to be ready in 10 to 15 seconds. But a lot of times it was, they say make ready, I'd pull up or pull out my gun, load the mag, and then immediately throw it back in my holster, take a deep breath or two, and I was going in. There was no like last minute like stage planning in my head or anything like that. Because off the like I was saying, the Casual Shooters podcast, they were saying if you would take too long at the world shoot, they tell you to unload, show clear, kick you to the back of the line. And if you do that again, you get a warning. So they have a different scoring system as well. We can get into that whenever you want, but they put warnings into the tablet and that travels with you all day. And if you get hit with a warning again, that's automatically a penalty. And that's up to the ROs and the CRO to give you that. So if you take too long, you immediately lose 10 points. So,
oh, it's automatic procedural.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, it's a good way to get the match moving. Question for both of you. Is the hands relaxed at sides really a disadvantage?
No.
Not when everybody's doing it.
But, I mean, compared to the whole weird, like, I don't know, I'm about to ride a horse. Like
they call it a monkey grip in IPSC, like monkey hands. That's what everybody was calling it.
Yeah.
I never felt super advantage. And if it is, I would say it's milliseconds, maybe 0.2 second disadvantage of drawing, which if you're drawing while moving into a position or taking a step, not really a disadvantage. I never felt like I lost anything because I was hands relaxed at sides.
Yeah.
So yeah, minor disadvantage, maybe if it's a stand and shoot and somebody's trying to scoop draw. But other than that, if you're moving into a position, which I always try to do, it wasn't bad.
Okay. What do you think, Peyton? I mean, you guys are basically staying with that style of draw since we're shooting IPSC Nats in less than a month, right?
Yeah.
It really didn't matter. Once we dry fired it enough and found a different index, just figuring out the new draw didn't really. Now, afterward, once I got back from Greece, I noticed that my draw was weird when I went to handgun nats, and it was because I was not going to hands relax at sides. So I actually had to revert to that to complete the match. So it was much of an advantage at all.
Yeah. I think I've also been doing the same. I've just been doing that because we're getting ready for IPSC nats, and I don't think it's really not that much of a disadvantage. I don't know. I might just roll with it. I think people overthink the whole wrist below belt and they try to game it a little too much. But that's just my opinion.
I think there's something calming to hands relaxed at sides too. Because if you're not focusing on trying to game so much, like you're focusing on the minor minutia, and then, you know, it's less things to worry about.
Right. And it's also equalizing too. It's like everybody. Yeah. No, I completely agree.
I don't know. One of the things like John Browning taught us is, like, whenever it's hands relax at size type grip, obviously you want to have your index point on your forearm and everything, but, like, you know, just to kind of throw your, you know, take your mind off of some stuff and stay relaxed, like, he was like, wiggle your fingers some, and if you wiggle your fingers, it'll take your mind off of, you know, whatever it is, and you'll just be a lot more consistent. And so like, whenever I'm about to go into like a stage or something, I'll have the index, I'll go in, I'll wiggle my fingers some just to kind of relax everything real quick, and then I'll just go right into it as soon as I hear the buzzer. And it's just a trick that's kind of, you know, I took that from John Browning, and it's kind of worked for me.
John's a smart guy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't remember the exact, like, I just know it kind of gets your mind off of things.
Yeah.
But, you know, IFSC, they're known for having tons of stages, complicated props that are high production value. What was your impression of the European Handgun Championship compared to like a USPSA level 3 match? And, you know, Peyton from Kansas, we'll start with you.
I was honestly surprised on the amount of open targets that were there. There was a lot of open targets with not very many hard targets. Okay. What's hard, like hard covers, no shoots. It was almost like it was all just, I'm gonna run this as fast as humanly possible and try to get alphas, and that's how everyone, which played to my style of shooting really well. But the overall like setup of it was a lot of short courses. There were some different swingers that I've never seen before. There was actual swingers that had little poppers at the end of them that are activated by poppers. So it was just a bunch of steel. Their poppers would send a lot of spalling back at you, which was really fun. And it just seemed like it was fun stages, but I feel like it could have been a little bit more challenging considering technical. A little bit more technical, because it was obvious positional shooting. And it was quick and it was fun, but I feel like there could have been a little bit more hard targets.
It took a lot of the thinking out of it, which, like, we're known to, like, yeah. We're known to, like, having stages where you have to think a lot.
Well, and, yeah. Prior, I went to a battle from the North Coast, and a lot of their stages were very puzzling. A lot of USPSA stages are, you have to use your mind.
Yep.
And
memory stages.
Yep. My experience with Greece, with a lot of them, was, you know exactly what's going to happen. There's targets that have 12 required shots. There's an opening. There's a movement sport to where you reload. And then the rest of the targets are just obvious shooting. So everyone is shooting the same exact way. And it seemed like it was a lot of given information.
Do you think that's one of the reasons why they're just like, hey, you have 5 minutes, walk through, done, go. Or 3 minutes.
That was my first IFSC experience, first ever IFSC match. So I'm not sure how other matches are ran. I've heard like Extreme GM, their matches are super crazy with wild activators. So I'm interested to see how the rest of the IFSC matches go and see how their stage setup is. But that's what I experienced at EHC.
You ever watch Maria Gushina whenever she's shooting a match or whenever she's training? Like, there's some of the targets that she's training on. I mean, it's wild. Like, I mean, she's a rock star shooter as it is, but I mean, like, and the same with Eric Griffel, just like the stuff that he can do.
Yeah. Just, there was Matt Nash told us about a stage to where there is an activator that would open a trap door underneath you. You're on top of like a platform. It'll open a trap door underneath you, and you would actually shoot beneath your feet, which I see. That's super cool.
Yeah. How about you, Steve? You, what do you got?
So I should say that I'm very thankful that I got to experience a level 4 match. So, you know, a level 4 match, just like the World Shoot, it's only occurring once every 3 years. So this year was Europe. Next year is the – what's the exact word? It's the Australia-Asia area. So it's going to be in, where is that? It's going to be in Laos next year. Mm-hmm. So it rotates the regions of the earth, you know, every 4 years. And then after that, it'll be the Pan American again and the World Shoot and whatnot. So very thankful for that. But yeah, like Peyton was saying, I was honestly surprised at how non-technical it was. So there was some hardcover, but the only hardcover targets, if I remember correctly, were slants. And the slants didn't cover any of the A zone up. So it was 100% A zone. You had half the C and then half the D covered up on the side of the target. There were no shoot targets, but again, no A zone was ever covered. The no shoots were always at the very bottom of the target, never to the sides or anything like that. And it started at the bottom of the A zone. So as long as you weren't throwing your shots low, you would never hit the no shoot. And then what I ultimately chopped it up to, like trying to rationalize why a level four seemed to be not as technical, is they were very proud of the amount of people that were coming to the match. It was more people than the world shoot. And it was 24 squads a day maxed out. And you had 20 minutes a squad to get everybody through. And it ultimately boiled down to max 2 minutes a shooter. And if there was very technical stages, those timelines would have never been met. In addition to, you can't leave the shooting area once you start shooting. And USPSA, everybody's pretty much used to 5 minutes walkthroughs. But 99.9 repeating of shooters are going the day before seeing other people shoot. But you can go at EHC, you could go and watch other people shoot, but you can't walk the stage, and you were restricted to 3 minutes. So not seeing the stage beforehand, not getting a good walkthrough, not being able to leave the shooting area because that's a penalty for shortcutting, all these things, wanting to push people through, I think led to them wanting quick stages. That isn't to say there wasn't like cool things. Like there was, like Peyton was saying, activated steel targets. So you'd hit a popper and then a moving steel would pop up. If anybody that shot Area 5 last year in 2022, there was moving steel way back in the corner, 20, 25 yard shot, something like that, through a no shoot hole. That was the first time I'd seen that in USPSA. So it was cool to see that again at EHC. There was a stage completely strong can that had two moving targets on it, one or two moving targets. And then there was a stage that was completely weak hand, where if you actually touched the gun with your dominant hand, it was a penalty, which I think that got challenged later on and actually overthrown in the arbitration committee. I'm not entirely sure. An American challenged something, and if I had to guess, that's probably what it was. But shooting activated targets, you know, and steal all of your non-dominant hand, I mean, first time I've ever seen that. So that was pretty interesting. So there was interesting things, but for the most part, most level threes were harder to shoot than EHC.
Okay. Yeah. Now, I'm wondering if they want to allow more people to have the experience, whereas the world shoot, they want to have just the best shooters there. But I mean, it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool either way. But having shot the match with the RO crew, how is that experience? Like just interacting with and shooting with ROs from around the world and getting to see their style of shooting. And then also, did the ROs travel from all over the world, or was it really just Europe and America?
So America, or Americans, I should say, aren't known in the IPSC world. People were very surprised that there were Americans working the match. So it was me, Peyton, and one other American. Those were the only ones. And it's usually only one American working IPSC matches. And he's actually a member of IROA, the International Range Officers Institute Academy, something like that. Association, there it is. So yeah, people were very surprised to see Americans at the match. So that was cool for them to see, I guess. But seeing other ROs was, IPSC is almost a personality. I think Americans take guns for granted, like how easy they are for us to get and how easy it is to shoot. Whereas other countries, that's not the case. So they fully embody like this personality of shooting IPSC. our squad, we had five people originally. One person didn't show up. So it was me, Peyton, and two other guys from Slovakia or something like that. I forget the exact country, but really cool guys, Alexander and another guy. I can't remember his name. They were actually really cool. They like, because we still were unfamiliar with the rules 100%. Like we had read the rule book and whatnot, tried to become accustomed to a few things, but even during the match, like we were asking questions. Like I did a drop step at one point. I'm like, oh snap, is that going to be a penalty? Cause I went outside the shooting area, and you know, some ROs and IPSC matches would give it to you, but others wouldn't. So talking to some Canadians, we had good conversations with them because they were the only other great English speakers there. So immediate like friendships, really.
Did you guys not have any of the Brits show up?
There was no Brit ROs. There was Brits shooting the match, but no ROs.
Okay. And the only reason why I asked that is like I have a bunch of three gun shooters that I'm friends with that you know, one of my friends, Clive, he is the president of the UK Practical Shooting Association. And so that's the only reason why I asked, like, and that's somebody I could put you in contact with, like, for future, next time you guys go overseas.
That'd be cool. I was actually really curious how Brits train for matches since, you know, guns are illegal.
So I'll break that. And guns are not completely illegal over in England. You are allowed certain types of rifles. Like you can have a high power rifle. I'm not going to go into the specifics. You can have shotguns. I have friends that have dissident arms shotguns over there that are UK compliant. Pistols, on the other hand, yes, you can't own a pistol over in England, Great Britain, all that. In Northern Ireland, though, you can. So there's a club where they do have the pistols up there. And so a lot of the English guys will travel up to Northern Ireland and go train up there.
That is like, you got to be committed for that.
Yes.
But yeah.
And so whenever they travel over here to the States, they will fall onto gear. They will fall onto gear in order to compete.
That makes sense. Yeah. A majority of the UK shooters were open shooters. So I was like, there's no way that these are like staying at their house. So I meant to ask one of them. And I think me and Peyton were talking about it at one point. We assumed there was a club somewhere. I didn't think it was Northern Ireland, but we just assumed it was somewhere they had a permit to keep it at the club to train like that. But yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
So, you know, there obviously RO culture. We'll get into that. How does the IPSC RO culture compare to USPSA's? You guys mentioned you guys worked Area 6, Delmarva, Mid-Atlantic this year. How was the experience working USPSA majors different from working the EHC?
I'll let Peyton touch on that first.
Yeah, with EHC and first experiences with IPSC ROs is it's a lot more of a culture for them. They take the game a lot super extremely serious, and it definitely showed they were professional. Steven talked at some point about if you were past your make ready time, they would give you penalties, and they were very very pertinent on that. I had an instance to where my CRO was very very strict on the rules. If anything small happened, they'd get a very quick verbal warning, and then they'd step on it immediately. With how many shooters there was, it was super important that the CROs acted like that. But most of them were, they knew the rules. They knew them all the way through. They didn't allow anything to fall through. If some small any incident happens, they'd be very quick to squash it. And they take it very seriously, because like Steven was talking about, we take firearms for granted here, and IPSC is kind of their only avenue to approach their firearm culture. And my CRO Sergio, he traveled from Spain with his family. He drove from Spain, which is pretty far from Greece, and he actually drove out there, and he was one of the unfortunate ones to get told that he can't shoot the match, and he stayed and he worked the entire thing, and it was like a marathon. work-wise, we were working really long hours due to the sheer amount of shooters. But compared to USPSA, I think they take it extremely serious, and it shows in their sport.
How about you, Steven?
Yeah, Peyton touched on a lot. They're very, very serious. So USPSA, so working a match isn't terrible in USPSA because you're joking around the whole time. Like, there's time to joke around with shooters. And once you're in a region for at least a year, everybody starts to know everybody. So now you're having conversations with everybody. And it doesn't, you know, take away from the match, but there is no time for conversation. I won't say at IPSC. There was no time for conversation at EHC. So if you see somebody you saw or knew, like some of the Americans, it'd be like a quick hello, let me check your gear, or like a quick hello, calling your name up. There was no time for conversation. It's very strict or straight and to the point. No joking around. You know, a lot of ROs, they would get done with the day and they'll, you know, drink, smoke, whatever, cigarettes, obviously. But that there was really none of that for IPSC. We were fortunate enough to have a rental, but most of the guys working the match were having to take the bus that the match was being providing. So they'd be on the bus at 5 and they wouldn't get back to the hotel till 5 or 6 p.m. at night. And then so that's 12, 13 hours on the range with a 30-minute lunch break, and then dinner was served between 7 and 9, and then it was rinse and repeat. There was something every single day. We had one off day a week, and then the weekends was working as well. The only time we didn't work on the weekends was when we avoided the opening ceremony because we were just completely burned out at that point, because it's also staff reset. The competitors do nothing. You shoot your stage and then you're just chilling the whole time. So it's like Area 6 was staff reset, but it wasn't that bad because we had 6 people on a stage resetting. I had 5 people sometimes, because one of the ROs brought his son out and he was helping reset steel. But for a 26 round stage, we had 3 people resetting everything, plus working the tablet and working the timer. It's a lot to do and you get burned out very fast. So they probably take it even more serious just because they're angry all the time of working so hard.
So usually in USPSA matches, the match director, I mean, yeah, you're not working as hard, but they usually do a pretty good job of taking care of you. And I'm hearing things about like all the other competitors needing to take a shared bus and all that stuff. I mean, did you guys get a staff dinner? Did you get like any other things to like that address the welfare of the ROs?
Oh yeah. There was a really nice staff dinner. Okay. They accommodated us pretty well. The staff dinner was nice. They brought us all out. We got to talk to Dino. They gave everyone gifts, kind of like a standard RO dinner. And it seemed like they genuinely cared about the actual people who worked the match, knowing that they're giving back. I think it's just the sheer amount of competitors that were there and the short they had that was unfortunate to where we had to work long hours and days. But
welcome to three gun, baby.
I will say when all the ROs out about the actual hours that we'd be working, that was a moment that's going to be in memory for a pretty long time.
Nobody expected it.
Yeah.
So, you know, you guys kind of hinted or quickly stated it, like they were very surprised to see like Americans out there competing, because it's mainly European, Asian, Australia, like it's everywhere except the US. Did you guys wear your jerseys at all, or did you guys just and how was that taken, you know, wearing the jersey and knowing that you're United States Marines, you know, on the Marine Corps shooting team? Like that was a new experience for them too.
Yeah. We shot both days of the match in our jersey, and then we actually didn't take, I don't own one. I don't know if Peyton does, NROI jerseys, like RO jerseys. 'Cause you know, in USPSA, you have to buy your own. And at USPSA matches, the match supplies a match jersey. So we went to EHC thinking that we would be provided some type of jersey, not knowing that we were supposed to bring our own jersey. So I RO'd a lot of the days in my Marine Corps jersey. And it was cool. A lot of people, a lot of the shooters obviously were foreign military as well. And a lot of them had had some type of training or had ran across the Marine Corps at some point. So a lot of people would tell us Semper Fi and just talk to us purely out of seeing the Eagle Globe and Anchor.
No, that's pretty cool. Peyton, what do you got?
So we did wear the jersey while we were ROing, and honestly, that was a huge, huge avenue for marketing and just getting to know people. Because as soon as they saw like the American flag, the Iwo Jima, the EGA, they're like, "Hey, Semper Fi, brother! How do I get more of people like you in our there to start talking?" That opened up a huge avenue of just information. I met a lot of military dudes who were trying to get in contact with us to train, and that was like avenues that I had to talk about other time. But it was just cool. It was a super cool experience to be able to wear the jersey and have so many people like they've never seen that before. They had no idea what it is, and just get handing out information. I'm pretty sure the team's Instagram page got like 150 followers while we were there, because I was just plugging it everywhere I can be, everywhere I was.
No, that's pretty cool. I mean, I'm just really happy that you guys were able to represent, you know, the Marine Corps the way you guys did. It's kind of a vision that I'm happy to see occurred. I got to ask, kind of thinking ahead, because you guys have this coming up pretty soon, but do you feel that competing in Greece has really prepared you for IPSC Nationals in November?
For sure.
Absolutely not. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, like Peyton was saying, I know me personally, I'm not really worried about the rule set or my gun or gear check for IPSC Nationals like I was going into EHC. Because like Peyton was talking about earlier, we both changed some gear around. I had to change my magazine ejection button because I read the rule set wrong, and you can't have any aftermarket buttons, and so I had to take mine off, throw the OEM on. I brought pins and a hammer out there ready to do complete gunsmith work. Like with Peyton was saying, I had a little box with every single spare part I could. So I'm not worried about the gun check, gear check, or knowing the rules or how my guns need to be set up, or not really worried about hands relaxed aside, no stage walkthroughs or anything like that. Really, seeing EHC and just experiencing how a level 4 match is run, I'm sure there's going to be a different flavor because it's US IPSC Nationals. Mm-hmm. But it really helped relax our minds for IPSC Nats.
Now, I have one more question, and this isn't match related. Like you guys traveling abroad in Greece, you know, what was your favorite sight that you saw, and what's the best food that you had over there?
So the coolest place for me going to Greece was actually a castle that we went up to at ancient Corinth. We drove up there, and it was really surreal. It was, do you remember how high up it was, Steven?
It was a couple thousand feet for sure.
It was wild because you can see all of where you've been, the ocean, and just like history. We were joking about being the guys on patrol walking the super slippery walk path that's just like polished by feet.
And Acrocorinth was the name.
Acrocorinth. And just getting like schwacked by archers that are watching the walls. That was super cool. And food wise, you can't go wrong. Whenever we went there and got Euros, Euros were everywhere, and they were always awesome. Euros and
Slovakia.
Yeah. Mm. What about you, Steven?
Yeah, so I am a huge ancient Greece fan. Sparta, Athens, Corinth. So just seeing all those sites was super cool. But, you know, because I've been such a huge fan so long, I think I was underwhelmed seeing things finally in person. But I would have to say The castle, the Acrocorinth castle, was probably my favorite just because I didn't expect it. And like Peyton was saying, we were goofing off, like, because we had visited ancient Corinth. And that was actually the place that had the most ruins left. But then we darted up the mountain, and we had 40 minutes or 30 to 40 minutes to try to see as much as we could. And we didn't get halfway through it. We're sprinting up this super smooth rock walkway, like trying not to fall and die. But yeah, just, you know, being honestly little kids thinking about, like, I'm a Roman archer, like, oh no, I'm on patrol and now I just got swacked by some raid.
I had very similar thoughts when I was in South Korea. I was in a mortar firing position, and we had a mountain literally right in front of our firing position. So that was really fun calculating, like, what charge we had to be on in order to get the round over the mountain and all that kind of stuff. But besides the point, like, I went hiking up the mountains, and I'm just thinking the entire time while I'm walking up that mountain, like, fuck me. If I have to, like, fight in this type of terrain, like, this would be fucking hell. I mean, I've had the luxury of fighting in a fucking desert, which has its own risk associated with it, but you throw that type of terrain into it, like, it's grueling. And I, you know, people don't think about that. It's rough.
It was cool just being on places where, you know, hundreds, thousands of battles were fought. Like, just obviously the terrain has changed, but knowing how much history went on there it's very enlightening. It's nice.
You know, given that you're really big into ancient history, I got a podcast for you, because I love ancient Greek history. I like Roman history, all that kind of stuff. There's a podcast called The Ancients. Just type in The Ancients. And it has everything from ancient Greece, Rome, you know, talks about, you know, Egypt, like, just covers that whole Mediterranean area.
Oh, yeah, I'm definitely looking that up then.
Yeah, that basically, like, I wanted to ask about your guys' trip and how it was as tourists. Did you guys bring back any souvenirs? And if so, like, what's the coolest souvenir you brought back?
I got this little statue. Ugh. So, Greek goddess right here.
Nice.
So, yeah, no, it's no, that's Aphrodite.
That's Rome. Yeah, Aphrodite.
Aphrodite. Athena's Greek too, but yeah, I got statues from Africa, from the Bahamas, and now Greece. So I try to get something from every place. And then I bought my daughter a necklace, and then I got my son a snow globe. Every country I've been to, or every state, I try to grab a snow globe. So collect those from all over the world. So that was cool. But the statue's probably my favorite.
Nice. Peyton?
You make me sound super lame, Steven. I got a coffee mug, man. I love coffee. Coffee mug that says ancient Greece. It's pretty cool.
I mean, that's something you use every single day that's going to remind you of your trip. That's pretty neat.
I mean, shoot, whenever I was overseas, I always just bought a shot glass from every country I went to.
I gotta get back now.
Yeah. Smaller footprint to pack. So another thing I'm curious about. So, like, you guys did a lot of matches in the U.S. over the summer. And in every single match, you're going to see Brian Connolly and Hunters HD Gold. You're going to see all these other vendors. What's the vendor footprint at an IPSC international match? What was that like?
That's actually a really good question, because I've never seen anything like EHC's vendor area. Like,
all right.
Saul Kirsch was there from Double Alpha, ooh, like, selling stuff himself. Every major IPSC vendor in the world was there. And they were all actually super cool. Like, Saul was a cool guy to talk to. Like, people had his book there and he was signing the books. Me and Peyton both bought gear there. IPSC for You was a company owned by a husband and wife, and they were there. Amazing jerseys. I bought a match jersey from them. And it's probably out besides the Marine Corps jersey, it's probably my favorite jersey now, just how comfortable it is to wear. So
I saw you wear that when you came in Shock QSC, and I was like, that is a very cool jersey. Yeah
gun company, the amount of gun companies, gear companies, jersey clothing, it blows USPSA out of the water. It blows national vendors out of the water for sure.
Yeah, it's really neat. What stood out to you, Peyton?
There was a lot of gun companies I've never seen before, and this might just because I'm not well versed enough with other companies besides Sig Sauer. But like Phoenix Trinity was there, and she was there. It was actually kind of cool to see a familiar face with Da Vinci. What else was there? A lot of CZ. CZ was super prevalent. There was Shield Sights, DPMS, Industries, and what was that? Yeah, Beretta.
Guga Rebus out there too.
He shot the match. He was actually a really nice guy to meet.
Did you guys meet? Was Eric Raffel out there?
Yep. Yes. With his entire production crew.
Nice. So he basically like walked up like a movie star, and he had. When you say production crew, are you talking about guys who shoot production or like actual cameramen?
Cameramen. Okay. And the posse that was following him just to watch him shoot.
Yeah. So that's another question. There were spectators, like dedicated spectators?
For most of the CZ guys, yes. Okay. Which was kind of funny because the CZ crew is the only people that were allowed to have their photographers follow past the rear fault line. It was strictly prohibited. But for the CZ guys, Eric Raffel, they were right next to him the entire time, which is kind of funny to see. That was the production Steven's talking about.
It was
interesting to see because obviously everybody knows Eric, and he seemed – I didn't have a conversation with him because he was in the middle of a match. He seems like a really nice guy, but he'd be like – for instance, he was in the middle of a stage walkthrough, and one of the random – ROs that were on my stage that he had just come that day to help because their job was done for the match and this was the last day, he asked him for a picture in the middle of his 3 minutes, and you got 3 minutes for a walkthrough. He's like, he holds his phone up trying to take a selfie with him, and Eric's like, hey, after the match please. He's like, oh yes.
Damn.
So I
did that too.
Yeah, that's wild. Okay, so that's really interesting. I'm glad I asked about the vendor area. Now, most of our batches here, we have catering in the form of Southern Barbecue. What's the Southern Barbecue equivalent over there in Greece?
You know.
It was one company who seemed like they had a monopoly over everything. So they gave the staff food, but there was staff food there, but we had to stop eating it because I was sick every day I ate it, like the worst stomach pains. So stopped eating that. They had Slovakia, a lot of grilled food there, a lot of traditional Greek food, but it was all served by the same company. And I think they were just paid by the match because, you know, almost 2,000 people there, you minus ROs, the match fee was a little over $400. So, I mean, the math can be done. It's almost $1 million. Match they were making, so I'm sure they were just catered to, and that's who gave us our RO dinner too. So they made really good food. Like Peyton was saying, the venue and the food was really nice for the RO dinner. But yeah, it wasn't a small company like Southern Barbecue.
Really interesting. I know for Ipsic World Shoot in Thailand, they had like a pop up 7-Eleven on the range. So I was just wondering what the setup was. Good to know that they had catering. Last thing I'll call out is, you guys went over there, you successfully came back. Peyton, you did awesome in terms of shooting, especially on staff day, knowing now that you guys have a squad of like five people. So Peyton finished 15th out of the production optics division. And I'm looking at your results right now. You actually hung a stage win for production optics on stage five, which is pretty freaking awesome considering that there are how many competitors there in production optics?
On 300, like 303.
Yeah. Does that qualify you for anything like in terms of EIC or whatever? Like, is there any international equivalent?
Not an international equivalent. That's purely Olympic. Okay. And that's the policy is right now.
Gotcha.
I mean, I don't know. I get it. I just, you know, one of the things, and this is what I would like to see changed. Like the Marine Corps obviously has, you know, Marine Corps medals that we give out for shooting. You know, I would love to see it let the Marine Corps be like, well, this is our program. You know, we hand out, you know, national points, Marine Corps medals, all that kind of stuff. I would like to see the same for international. And that's just me thinking, like, you go to a major international match, like, screw, you know, USA Shooting, screw, you know, international distinguished on that side. Like, got it. Like, those guys earn every bit of that. I'm not trying to discredit them, but like Marine Corps recognition, like, I would love to see the policy change to where guys on the in the Marine Corps could go distinguished internationally in those regards.
But it's awesome that you guys went, and I'm glad that you guys had a great time as tourists, as shooters, as ROs, getting to experience the entire thing. And I hope this, you know, this is a sign of more to come. I think you guys, the pistol team, has had a fantastic summer season, and I think you guys are going to continue to progress. You know, we're about to talk to John Treat, John Bodziak, and Chris Cachola about Scotland. But also, I mean, you guys went and you performed really strong at Handgun Nationals. So I don't think it's outside of the realm of possibility that you guys are going to be traveling internationally in the future. Appreciate your guys' time. I thought, you know, we've been wanting to talk about this for a while, but glad we actually got to sit down and talk about your guys' experience. Before we wrap up, any last words for the listeners just about your experience or shooting in general? Steven, we'll start with you.
America's number one.
Hell yeah, brother.
No, you know, I've traveled with the Marine Corps all over the world, and America is still the best. You know, there's nothing like it. So,
do you find that traveling makes you appreciate what you have here in the USA that much more?
100%. Yeah, I think people who complain about the country haven't traveled enough and seen the bad sides of the world.
Yes, I completely agree. Peyton, last thoughts?
America. That's America. I'm so
in on God. Oh, all right. We might just start a four-person USA chant to finish out this podcast. But thanks again, guys. Really.
USA.
USA. USA. Nothing more American than that.
For real, we're not going to put this video up, but we're all shotgunning viewers right now. But thanks again, guys. Really, really great conversation. And we're looking forward to having you guys back on to talk about, you know, IPSC Nats and just you know, the Mi'kmaqs and all the great things that you guys are going to be doing in the future. To our listeners, you know, hope this was a good insight into what the Marine Corps shooting team is doing, but also a little bit into the world of IPSC, which we are going to be shooting a lot more in the future. Let us know how we're doing, and we look forward to seeing you next time.